We are KOWS Occidental, 92.5 FM, streaming on the web at kowsfm.com.
Yeah, hi, this is Bernie Steffen, and I'm doing my premiere show today called Ecologic. And I'm excited to be doing this show where we talk about honest, no bull conversations about the world we've built and what we're leaving behind. And I'm delighted to welcome my very special guest. His name is Max Wilbert. Max, are you on the line?
Yeah, hey, Bernie, I'm here. The music is a little loud over your voice, so I can't hear you very well, but I'm here.
Okay, well, I think we should have the music turned off right by now. And I want to introduce Max here. He's a community organizer, a wilderness guide, and the co-founder of the anti-mining group called Protect Thacker Pass. He holds a master's degree in degrowth and currently works for the Community Environmental Defense Fund. He's also the co-author of Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. And he publishes a newsletter called Biocentric. So welcome, Max. We have you over the phone line. You are in Oregon, right?
Yeah. Hey, Bernie, it's good to be with you. I'm still hearing the music quite loud. So again, I don't know if you can turn that off or the engineer can, but I can't hear very well.
Okay, I'm going to turn that off.
No, Bernie, this is starting to stop right there.
Okay, it's off now.
All right, I'm with you. Hi.
My apologies.
Glad to be here.
I'm getting a little help, and I'm fumbling around, but I think we can make it through the hour. So,
I'm glad to be with you for the inaugural show. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're a very special guy, and I'm delighted you're my first guest here. And today, our topic is the failure of scientific imagination. This is something you've written about and talked about, so I look forward to chatting with you, and we won't run out of things to say, but
absolutely.
When we talk about scientific information, just the word science, as we use it in our civilization, in our society, I think it carries a lot of weight, but it's misused a lot. I find that it's sometimes conflated with technology. And do you want to speak on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, the reason for that is because the history of the development of science coming out of the Enlightenment is wrapped up in the history of empire, which has gone hand in hand with technological development, or what we could call technological escalation. And so, you know, whether you're looking at like Renaissance era scientists, people like Leonardo da Vinci, who were researching, you know, human bodies and geometry and sort of unlocking some of these fundamentals of human knowledge, at the same time, they were, you know, on the payroll of various nobles and wealthy people. You know, in that era, it was sort of the city-states of what's now Italy, to build weapons, to improve fortifications, to to facilitate warfare in various ways. And that process accelerated, you know, as I mentioned, during the Enlightenment. We're looking at people like Francis Bacon and the rise of the Royal Society in Britain. And that was wrapped up in the colonialism that was happening at that time, that the British Empire was really spreading around the world to become the largest empire in world history. And their scientific process was very much part of that. And they were deeply, deeply ensconced with each other. You know, one example of this that people don't think of is botanists, you know, people who we think of as, you know, loving plants, loving the natural world, and so on. Early botanists were largely working for the British Empire to figure out what type of plants in these different colonial properties owned by Britain could be monetized, could be turned into new cash crops, new export crops, could be turned into weapons and different forms of medicines, commercially useful things that would you know, financially power the empire and the sustenance of these colonies, and would also empower further growth. So that really continues up until the modern day, where today most research and development in science, in technology, takes place in universities, in corporate laboratories. And often these places have direct links to the military-industrial complex. Probably many listeners to the show will be aware of the long-time links between, for example, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Initiative, I believe it's called DARPA, and many of the technologies that we use every day today, smartphones, the internet, touchscreens, all of these things came out of military research, or at the very least, research that was sort of jointly being done between corporate commercial scientists and with funding and support from the government and the military.
That is indeed very interesting. I appreciate you giving us a little context. One form of science that we first learn is it's like math. It's a neutral term. It's about, you know, a process to go through to develop evidence and make decisions based on reality. And I've used the shorthand, that's small s science. And the modern science that gets conflated with our technology, I call with a capital S science, or with a dollar sign science. And that's what gets funded, and that's what often gets promoted as you've got to listen to this science. And I'd say that we all need to go back to thinking about science more, that we can all use it as a tool, much as we use math. It's not about the results as much as the process of learning what the real world is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right about that. And that's where we see science has also been wrapped up in racism, because the colonial project was sort of ideologically fueled by these racist understandings of the world. And of course, you know, early racism was really supported by scientific racism, which looked at, you know, phenotypical differences in how people look and mapped them onto intelligence, onto ability to build complex civilizations and so on. You know, so science was put to use in the service of racism. And along those, it's sort of reflected back in many ways today. So a lot of people, it's starting to change, of course, among, you know, listeners of this program, communities who are progressively minded. You know, people are starting to understand more and more that what we might call traditional ecological knowledge is a form of highly complex science, you could say. You know, other people might not use that term, but you know, similar in that it is based on observing cycles in the natural world, coming to various theories and hypotheses about why those things might be, testing those over time, observing changes in response to different variables, and then sort of changing behavior based on that, right? That's a form of the scientific method. And it's a very complex form. You know, you think about Polynesians navigating across the entire Pacific Ocean without compasses, without GPS, by using, you know, the stars and currents in the ocean and various forms of dead reckoning. Like, that's an incredibly complex, difficult thing to do, and then hit an island that's a few miles across, you know, in the biggest ocean on the world. It takes a level of sophistication in thinking and deduction and reasoning that most people today can't, certainly yeah. could never manage, right?
As you're talking about that example, I know that a lot of folks are now contrasting sort of our modern society's science with what is known with traditional ecological knowledge. This is what you're talking about as indigenous peoples has developed a understanding of the natural world and what is happening. And it's their science, but they don't use the word science. And I think that idea of what they even call it TEK in some cases. And I hate the use of the word science being corrupted in a sense of it still is the scientific process is an honorable thing that we don't want to lose. What we don't want to do is be misguided by what people who are being paid in their scientific research to find as, well, this is natural because it's science. It's coming out of science.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people think that science is neutral, right? A lot of people think that technology is neutral. And I disagree with that. I think that's a very dangerous thing. I think science and technology have inherent value to them. They lead down certain paths and they foreclose other paths. So, for example, you know, developing nuclear science, splitting the atom, led to the development of nuclear weapons. It led to the Cold War. It led to uranium mining, you know, on the Navajo Reservation, still poisoning people today, 75 years later. It led to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It led to the bombings of the Bikini Atoll and these different places where nuclear weapons have been tested, many of which are still contaminated today. It led to Fukushima. It led to Chernobyl. It led to all these different things, right?
Yeah.
And of course, we can say it also led to nuclear medicine. It led to, you know, X-rays, the variety of tools that are used in science and used for health and people's well-being. Yes, that's true. But the other things were wrapped up in it as well, right? And so,
yeah,
these technologies have inherent qualities to them.
And
this is especially true of a lot of the modern technologies that are very dependent on mining, on fossil fuels, on high energy systems of various sorts. These things both require and reinforce certain modes of development, certain pathways of social development. And we can't ignore that. We can't just say science is neutral. It's what we do with it.
We have to understand
the quality itself.
Yeah, I wanted to add the idea that our human knowledge has grown exponentially for quite a while, such that today in the advancement in the sciences, there's so many silos. There's thousands of PhDs working to advance one particular aspect of human knowledge. And the idea is that most of us can't wrap our minds around it. We can't pull wisdom out of that complexity and all that is scientific results that is being advanced every single day. And I feel like that chasm is growing bigger and bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, again, that's sort of one of the pathways of development that's been unlocked by the trajectory of science and the accumulation of knowledge that we have been embarked upon in this culture, you know, in what was in this industrial civilization that we live in today, right? It's extreme specialization of knowledge, and it is the loss of wisdom. It is the loss of community. In a way, these things are linked. I think that just one example of that, again, to return to the idea of nuclear power, nuclear energy, nuclear technology, to develop these type of technologies, you don't just need a few people in a lab doing research, right? You need thousands of researchers and postdoctorates and scientists doing all kinds of experiments. You need mining that provides them with the raw materials to conduct their experiments. You need factories that build the equipment that they use to conduct the experiments. You need supply chains to get everything where it needs to be. You need energy to run the equipment. You need places which are deemed sacrifice zones on which you can test and dispose of toxic aftermath of these experiments. And so there's all this is wrapped up in the process. We can't separate it out and say this is a neutral, an entirely neutral thing.
I had an experience of talking to a scientist at Stanford who was studying single cell life, and I wanted to ask him. I said, "How come there are so many intelligent people in the universities that are in the sciences that they can't seem to deal with the climate change issue in aggregate?" And his point to me was, well, there are climate scientists that are working on it. In other words, he believes that in the various silos, in aggregate, we will solve all these problems. But the truth is that by going down all of these paths of more and more knowledge, we seem to get further and further away from dealing with what are root issues when it comes to why we are experiencing climate change now.
Yeah, and just to speak to that, you know, there are a lot of scientists that I have a lot of respect for. So I hope if there are scientists listening, if there are folks who see the value in science who are listening, that they're not being turned off by this conversation, because there are a lot of scientists who are doing incredibly important, beautiful work and not falling into these traps that we've been talking about. So, you know, of course, we're making some generalizations. We're talking big picture here. But yeah, one example of what you're talking about, Bernie, if you hear some noise in the background, there's some wild turkeys right next to where I'm sitting, like 10 feet away, and they're making some calls and talking to each other as some more friends come out of the bushes across the way here. One example of what you're talking about, that sort of siloing of the thinking, is I had an opportunity back in 2010 to go to Russia. At the time, Russia and the U.S. had much better relationships, to go to Russia as part of a climate science expedition. It was funded by the National Science Foundation, and so there were a bunch of professors and postdocs and PhD students, and there were also, you know, master's students and undergrad. It was a big expedition. There were probably about, 40 of us who went there. And we went to this very remote area in northeastern Siberia along the lower Kolyma River. If people are familiar with the book Kolyma Dreams about some of the gulags and work camps under the Soviets, the Kolyma River is the area where a lot of that was taking place. And so very remote area, you know, very difficult to get there. And we stayed in this science station that has been in place for something like 20, 30 years at this point, where a few Russian scientists and their families have been studying global warming, studying the thawing of permafrost, carbon cycles in these Arctic tundra landscapes up there, studying methane release from subsea permafrost and from thawing permafrost. And so I was there. I'm not a scientist, but I've always been a science communicator, you might say, somebody who really sees the value in having scientific literacy, in figuring out ways to communicate that to the general public, and in making the most of especially ecological sciences and what they teach us about the crisis that we're facing today. So I was there to document the work that was going on, to do photography, to write, to record video, and so on. And, you know, the scientists are going out every day and they're measuring permafrost thaw, and they're capturing methane bubbling out of these lakes, and they're sampling, you know, algae blooms and doing all this research to measure what's going on. And afterwards, we go back to our bunkhouse, which is in this old barge floating on the side of a small tributary of the Kolyma. And, you know, we're just hanging out and eating our food and talking and relaxing. And we're there for quite a while. And one of the things that I was struck by in this whole experience was exactly what you're talking about, Bernie. The extent to which these scientists, many of whom were literally among the top experts in the world on global warming in the Arctic, how little they actually wanted to talk about the politics of it and changing it. It seemed like the general perspective among most of them was that's for politicians to deal with and society to deal with. Our job is to do the science and provide the best quality information possible so that society can make rational decisions based on that information.
Well, that's a good point for me. Let me interrupt so that listeners who just tuned in is, I'm Bernie Steffen, and this is Ecologic, our first show, and my guest, whom you're listening to, is Max Wilbert. And Max is quite fluent in all of this subject. He's written a lot, and what I really like about you, Max, is you tie all of our issues back to our civilization and what we're doing to other species and what we're doing to the lands and property of indigenous people, that we are destroying that which is not creating climate change, but we keep bringing in more and more technology to fight climate change, and in doing so, we're actually making the problem worse. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, this is, I think, one of the consequences of what we've been talking about, this sort of scientific approach to solving cultural problems. I don't think the global warming crisis is primarily a technological problem. I don't think it's primarily an engineering problem. And in that, I disagree with people like Rex Tillerson, who is the former CEO of ExxonMobil. And Tillerson became Secretary of Energy, I believe, under Trump's first term. And he said global warming is an engineering problem. That was his approach to it. He acknowledged that global warming is happening, but he said it's an engineering problem. And what do you do with engineering problems? You apply technology, essentially. You build things. You change the way you're doing things in a technical way to address the problem. I don't think that's what global warming is. I think it's something much different than that, in fact. I think it's a symptom of a broken relationship with the planet. I think it's a symptom of a fundamentally flawed approach of looking at the natural world as resources, as a place to extract from, as a place to dump pollution, and as something to manage using the methods of science in many cases, as well as, you know, management techniques borrowed from the business world and so on. To manage in order to deal with problems.
I want to punctuate that a little bit, if you allow me here, because I was definitely starting out as a climate activist when about in 2010, and doing a talk show on KWMR, and I was in line with people like Bill McKibben with 350.org, and I was definitely pulled into the green revolution, if you will. But I quickly learned that wasn't taking us in the right direction. We were missing the bigger picture that you're talking about, and that's why I'm so excited having you as a guest on this show today. You made that connection in much of what you've written in the past, like your authorship of Bright Green Lies, and I use that term Bright Green Lies liberally as a result of you having, and people like Ozzie Zehner, that have seen through the fact that it's not just a climate change problem. Climate change is a symptom, and aiming at reducing the carbon in the atmosphere misses the other aspects of the destruction that our civilization is doing to the natural world and our future.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I believe that solar panels and wind turbines and electric cars were going to save the world for quite a while. You know, I started studying global warming when I was young in the early 2000s, just reading about it. In the time, it wasn't being covered much. You know, there certainly was almost nothing in the newspaper. And I really thought that those technologies were going to save us, to be a big contributor to saving us, at least. But luckily, I think I'd been schooled in, you know, not just a critique of global warming as a problem, but also an understanding that that capitalism is one of the major drivers of our ecological crisis, that there's a relationship between exploitation of workers, the destruction of the planet, the destruction of indigenous people's lands and theft of their lands, and the climate issue that we're facing. And you know, I was just lucky to be exposed to those type of politics when I was young. So I never fully bought into those technologies. You know, I believed in them. I thought they were important, but I saw them as one part of sort of a comprehensive social transformation that was needed in order to address global warming. You know, what we're seeing today from many proponents of using technologies to solve global warming is that technology is basically it. You know, you look at the Biden administration's climate plans, and what they are is essentially, let's maintain business as usual, industrial capitalism, the U.S. as an empire dominating the rest of the world militarily and through various trade practices, predatory trade practices. But let's just power it with fossil fuel or with solar and wind and geothermal and so on.
Yeah,
it's a Freudian slip because, of course, Biden pumped far more oil than Trump did under Trump's first administration, at least. You know, Biden sort of continued this all-of-the-above energy strategy, which was let's bring on these other sources of energy as well.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is what is lost when we take that approach. You know, as soon as we concede that industrial capitalism is going to continue in more or less the form it has now, that means we're conceding the ongoing colonization and destruction of indigenous lands. We're conceding the ongoing sixth mass extinction of life on Earth. We're conceding more and more plastics and dioxins and forever chemicals, PFAS, and all of these other toxic substances contaminating our world. We're conceding an increasingly dystopian ecological future, but for one in which, you know, maybe we're lowering carbon emissions to some extent.
And you're speaking, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I feel passionate about this too, and I want to add some ideas that you're bringing up that are so important. But it's also our political structures, like the notion that Biden could do anything else, because in our system, you get elected based on economics, and we are trying to govern hundreds of millions of people by one set of rules and one set of priorities and all that. And so I've come to the belief that what I used to learn was think global, act local. But I've come to now believe that we need to start thinking local and acting local, because thinking globally and looking to global solutions or even national solutions won't get us anywhere. I believe very strongly, and this is what motivates me to do this show, is that we really all need to look to where we live in the watershed, in the ecosystem, with the other species that we're connected to, and the people that we live here, not the virtual people we meet over Facebook or social media of all sorts. It's really local, local, local that fuels me. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think you're right to some extent. You know, I think that the problems that we're dealing with are obviously global in scale, and I think that there's certainly value in understanding what's happening globally, in you know, understanding the United States' role in geopolitics and how that plays into the ecological crisis, what's happening in Venezuela, for example. The foreign intervention in Venezuela is linked to trying to destabilize Cuba and trying to destabilize China and trying to destabilize these geopolitical rivals of the United States in order to increase the power of this country. But in terms of how do we approach these issues, how do we solve these issues, I wish that there was a silver bullet that I could present to people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There have been obviously we've all been working on how to solve these crises for a long time. You know, for longer than I've been alive, people have been working on this, and we haven't been able to come to a positive outcome. You know, there are many reasons for that, but I always just try to remember the fact of power in all this, because in my analysis, in my view, the destruction of the planet is not a mistake. It's not a misunderstanding. It's not an accident. It's happening because certain forces, certain people, certain institutions in society are deliberately choosing to do so in order to increase their own wealth and power.
And to name that group, I call that, and I think you call that, industrial civilization, as opposed to other civilizations, other cultures, which are indigenous. None of the indigenous cultures are destroying the planet as we are responsible for climate change. That is the domain of one set of people. I hate it when people say climate change is human caused. Well, no, it's not our species. It's one organization that used to be called Western civilization that has now dominated the global culture and is a global industrial civilization.
Yeah, and the thing is, Bernie, you know, we're wrapped up in this. You know, here I am living in the United States. I'm looking out across the place where I live, which is Eugene, Oregon. I'm looking out across the city right now, and we're all dependent upon the system, right? My food comes from the grocery store for the most part. Since learning about the ecological crisis, I've worked increasingly more and more to become more self-sufficient, to get my food locally, to do all these kinds of things. But nonetheless, I'm dependent on the system, you know, and most of us are. And I think a lot of people see that and they think about the things that they enjoy that come from industrial civilization, whether it's, you know, TV shows or ice cream or hot showers or modern medicine, things that we enjoy or are dependent on that come from this society, and they say, we can't challenge industrial civilization. We can't challenge industrial modernity, because then what would we have?
Yep.
But I think about this in a different way. I think that rather than sort of adopting this way of life because it's the best way to live, most of the people that have adopted this way of life have done so because they had no other choice.
Correct.
You know, there's a term for this that I learned a number of years ago called forced proletarianization. It's using the term proletarian as in worker, wage worker. And forced proletarianization is a process whereby people who used to be self-sufficient, who used to, say, grow their own food in their community, support themselves from the land around them, and, you know, rely on themselves along with maybe some trading with their neighbors and people in their local areas. And those people being forced into a situation where they could no longer do that, where in order to survive, they had to work for somebody else. They had to work for a wage. They had to go into the economy.
Yeah.
They had to get health care from the system and so on. They had to get their housing from the system. Because the land had been privatized. What was once commons was now privatized. It belonged to somebody else. And you need to pay them in order to have a place to live. You need to pay somebody else for your food because you don't have land to grow it on. You don't have land where you can go hunt and gather. And if there is land, then maybe the food is poisoned. Or maybe you can't get there because you don't have transportation. Or maybe there just isn't enough of it because the population has grown so much.
So
This is forced proletarianization, and it's difficult for us in our modern way of thinking to even get our minds wrapped around this, because we have been colonized for so long. You know, my friends who are native, I've done a lot of work in the Great Basin. I was just working with my friend Shelley, doing an op-ed writing about Thacker Pass. She's Paiute, and you know, she was talking about how the mines and the industrial projects in her area are destroying more of their traditional hunting grounds, more of the places where they gather food medicine plants. So her people were only colonized like 150 years ago. They remember, right? They remember the old ways.
Yep.
They remember not that it was a utopia, everything was perfect, everyone was happy, but that they were free, right? They had freedom. They had autonomy. They had their land. They had their community. And then that was stolen by the United States through a process of settler colonialism. That happened to my ancestors, too, in Europe. It was just thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't recent. We don't remember it. I don't remember it.
Well,
right? And so a lot of my work is aimed towards how do we work to fight and dismantle this industrial civilization that we live in while simultaneously, you know, building and returning to more time-tested ways of living, low-energy, local ways of living in relationship with the land where we live, because that the only sustainable societies that have ever existed lived in that way.
Yep.
And the whole idea that we can live in technological modernity and make it sustainable, that idea is at best a theory, and I would call it a crackpot theory, because the evidence does not support that.
This is a good spot to take a little break, which I need to do as part of this having community radio here. And first, let me remind people that this is a new show called Ecologic. I'm Bernie Steffen, and my guest is Max Wilbert. And I'm going to play a little piece about our sponsors.
Cows thanks Cloverdale Connect for their support. Cloverdale Connect delivers their free paper every month to homes, businesses, and post office boxes in the greater Cloverdale area. They are also available online at cloverdaleconnect.com.
Cows thanks Dr. Robert Shulman for his support. Dr. Shulman is board certified in a broad spectrum of physical and integrative medicines, as well as prolotherapy. His offices are located at 95 Montgomery Drive in Santa Rosa. You can find out more at westcountyintegrativemedicine.com.
So we're back, and we do thank the sponsorship of Community Radio, I think, is one of these forums that we're still lucky to have. You know, so much of our media has become nationalized, and it can't address the issues we're talking about today. And even though we can't live, or it's very, very difficult to drop out of this modern world, as we were talking about, but we can think outside of it, and we can talk outside of it. So I love what you're saying, Max, and I like that you're connected not only to the wilderness and wanting to protect the other species and the ecosystems that still are functioning, and connected to indigenous people. So I met you out at Thacker Pass, which is a lithium mine that you and Will Falk partnered on to fight and put up a good stand. But in the end, you wound up getting arrested, and it seems like the water rights are being sold from a rancher that to use to do that lithium mining. Do you want to expand on that catastrophe a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, I've been part of the radical environmental movement for more than 15 years at this point. So I've been involved in a lot of campaigns over the years. A lot of them have been fighting fossil fuels. So, you know, tar sands in Utah, coal trains and oil train transportation through Washington State and Oregon, coal export terminals, all kinds of fossil fuel projects, pipelines. I've also been involved in fighting logging and so on. But in 2020, I learned about this mining project called Thacker Pass, a lithium mine. And it was planned for a place in northern Nevada, right near the Oregon border. And I went down to the site to see what it was like because, I'm somebody who loves to camp and spend time out in wild places. And I've learned over the years that when you're fighting the destruction of the natural world, it's really important to go there, to be in person in these places which are threatened, to take action at those places. It's not just important for strategic reasons, but also for moral and spiritual reasons to just be in these places. So I went down there and I fell in love with that place. And I made a bunch of phone calls and talked to people throughout the environmental movement. And it became clear pretty quickly that almost nobody was going to fight for this place. Nobody was going to fight this mine. At the time, it seemed like maybe one local rancher was going to file a lawsuit because he was worried about his water being impacted by the project. It seemed like maybe some small environmental groups were going to contest the permit for the mine. But it just seemed like one of those projects that was likely to just kind of fly under the radar and get built, and nobody would ever be the wiser. You know, very rural, remote area. And just a place where it's easy to sneak something past people. And I decided that it was important to fight that for that place, not just because it's ecologically important. You know, we're talking about a place where sage grouse live and bobcats and mountain lions and pronghorn antelope and mule deer and rattlesnakes and Pacific tree frogs and horned lizards and pygmy rabbits and burrowing owls and thousands of other creatures live there. But also for the reason that it's a lithium mine. And lithium, of course, is the main ingredient, one of the main ingredients in electric car batteries and in energy storage batteries to store wind and solar energy for times when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, right? So I decided we needed to fight this mine because it was symbolic of what a lot of people see as a solution to global warming and the ecological crisis, because it represented this new frontier of ecological destruction, which isn't really new. You know, this green extractivism, extracting raw materials for the so-called green economy, that where the extraction is being done in the exact same ways, with the exact same winners and losers and harms and externalities and pollution and habitat destruction, as we've seen with fossil fuels and with industrial projects for hundreds of years. And so I decided we need to fight this because if we don't, then this idea that the green energy transition is this simple, untrammeled good will go unchallenged too. And so we went out there, and in January 2021, we set up a protest camp. We ended up living at Thacker Pass, camping out on the side of a mountain about a mile above sea level. From January 15th, 2021, a few days after January 6th, the Capitol riot, until October, November of that year. And then at that point, the federal government started trying to fine me and my friend Will Falk about $50,000 for essentially blocking the mine. They called it illegal occupation and development of public lands because we built a pit toilet latrine for Native elders. Because after we got out there, it became clear, we started connecting with Native folks from the area, and it became clear that this was a sacred site. It was very culturally significant to the Indians, the indigenous people from that area, Paiutes, mainly northern Paiutes, but western Shoshone and other people as well. And they only learned about the mine from us when we went out there and started protesting it, because the permitting for the project was rushed through. It was all done during the pandemic. It was fast-tracked under the Trump administration. So a process that would usually take 4 or 5 years and would involve, you know, long public comment periods and education for the community and letting people know about how the project was going to be, that never really happened. And so the tribes largely didn't even know that the mine was coming until we started getting in the news for being out there protesting. And so, again, we figure out it's a sacred site. The protest movement grows. And we ended up working with several tribes from around the area, the Burns Paiute Tribe, Summit Lake Paiute Tribe, and Reno Sparks Indian Colony, to file federal lawsuits against the project. There's more protest camps that get established. We go out there and take direct action in 2023 and block construction. But in the end, the mining company sues us. There's various forms of state repression that we're dealing with, and the mine is being built as we speak. So the sacred site's being bulldozed, all that habitat, thousands and thousands of acres, about 17,000 acres, 18,000 actually, are being destroyed for the mine, and billions of gallons of water being pumped out of the aquifer to support this mine. And all this is moving forward, despite huge amounts of opposition from the communities in the area. So it was a huge fight. We weren't able to stop the mine, which, frankly, isn't that surprising, because the law is set up in this country to facilitate this type of resource extraction. I mentioned that this area has been colonized for 150 years. It was first colonized for silver mining. And now it's still a mining district for the United States Empire. And mining is heavily protected under U.S. law, from laws going back to the 1860s that prioritized mining on public lands. So, it's really an uphill battle to stop a mine like this, at least when you're working within the boundaries of the law. I really think that the only way that these type of mining projects are ever going to be stopped on a serious basis and on a widespread basis is if we don't fight project by project, and instead we're working to bring down the entire edifice of industrial capitalism, industrial modernity. That whole thing needs to fall, because as long as that sort of machine continues growing, building, expanding, discovering new technologies, building new things, they're going to need more and more mining. They're going to need to destroy more and more places for the raw materials to support that. And so, that's where I think we need the systemic thinking. And that's why part of our goal with the campaign was, of course, to stop the mine and protect that place, which we weren't able to do. But part of our goal was to question the entire logic behind the project. And in that sense, I think we were somewhat successful. I think we helped shift the conversation around lithium mining specifically, but more broadly, green technology in general, around the country and around the world. We were on the front page of the New York Times, Le Monde, The Guardian, BBC. We were on NPR, and of course, all the, alternative movement media spaces as well. Trying to spread this message, not just that this one project is bad, but that this entire trajectory of development that so-called green technology represents is a false solution to the problem that we're facing, that we need to go much deeper and get to the roots of the ecological crisis if we want to have a chance in hell of stopping it.
I think you're absolutely right, and I see evidence that more and more people are understanding that solving how we drive with what fuel isn't the answer, but driving less is part of the answer. Not flying, as opposed to trying to make airplanes not pollute using fossil fuels, etc. So people are coming around, but it's a slow process. And I think a lot of it hinges on what you talked about earlier, where to try to live outside of modern civilization is virtually impossible. When I talk about what I think we need to do and focusing on living locally and simply, people say, Bernie, but I don't see you doing it. Well, I'm now 77 years old, and I wasn't really trained to grow my own food, to build my own shelter, to live off the grid. Yet I see young people striving to do that because they recognize the harm that continuing in the way that we're going. And I know that when I first met up with you and your colleagues like Derek Jensen and Keith, I forget her name, your co-authors, it was around deep green resistance. They put on a program in San Francisco. Were you at that program? I don't remember.
I was, yeah. I'm no longer part of that organization.
Yeah, they had a feeling that we needed to bring down this civilization. And a lot of people still think that way. I believe that we don't really need to do that in that it is going to self-destruct. Unfortunately, in the collapse that we're already witnessing in a lot of dimensions, it's a slow process. It's a painful process. A lot of people dying, a lot of people getting hurt. It's not a pretty picture. But I don't think that we should shy away from having the kind of discussion we have had here today, Max. And let me ask you, are you willing to come back on this show at a future date? Because there's so much more to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd be happy to.
Well, let me just mention that you're listening to Max Wilbert, where if you Google him, you learn a lot. And you have your own website, maxwilbert.org, and your newsletter, which I think is really amazing, and you're quite prolific. Maybe every week you put out a new piece. It can be found on Substack, and it's called Biocentric. I highly recommend that people check out the work you're doing, Max, because you're a thought leader, and we need to hear more from you. So I'm super pleased that you agreed to help me today get this show off the ground. I look forward to hearing more about this, and I'll give you a few words, but first let me say that our next show, this is every 2 weeks, will be on February the 2nd, Monday at 11, and my guest will be Richard Heinberg. He's a Santa Rosa native. He's a globally known expert on fossil fuels and energy, prolific author as well, senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, and I'm very pleased that we're going to tackle the subject of energy limits of industrial civilizations. So that's something to look forward to. But again, I want to thank you, Max, and let me give you a couple minutes here to wrap up in any way that you see reasonable.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks, Bernie. I appreciate you having me. And I would just say that I think that there's a lot of good work that needs to be done on these issues. There's no shortage of work that needs to be done. And, you know, for me, part of the work I do these days, I have a part-time gig with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is mostly known for bringing rights of nature approaches to the United States, the first rights of nature law in the U.S. in 2007. But these days, the organization is pivoting to some extent because we've seen rights of nature be struck down repeatedly in the courts. We knew that was going to happen from the beginning. You know, we thought it was worthwhile doing anyway as a community organizing approach, an exercise in educating communities and the public about how sustainability is actually illegal under U.S. law. It's illegal. It's outlawed to do things in a sustainable way because corporations have more rights than people do, and certainly than ecosystems, than animals, wildlife, forests, rivers, grasslands do. And my work with that organization, I'm co-director of the Community Resistance and Resilience Program. And the idea behind that program, you know, we can't do it for other people, but the idea is that all of our communities need to be embarking on this two-pronged approach to the crisis that we're facing. We need to be building resilience, building tangible alternatives to the industrial system that we're relying on for our day-to-day necessities of life. Because, you know, for various reasons, whether we're talking about the rise of fascism and corporate power and inequality, as well as climate breakdown and the ecological crisis, we need to relocalize. We need to come back to sustainable practices of living. And at the same time, we need to resist the destruction of our planet and the oppression of communities all over this country and all over the world. You look at ICE running wild right now. So we are really trying to encourage, support, work with communities, provide them with resources and training and assistance as they go through this process of building resilience and resisting the destruction that's happening. We think this is really important, and so that's my role with the organization. So I hope that people will reach out to me through CELDA, CELDF.org, or you can find my Substack or my website and reach out, you know, if you want to connect, if you want to work together. And I'm glad to, again, to be the inaugural guest on your show, Bernie. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to the audience, and thanks to everyone who's been listening to the show. I appreciate you taking your valuable time to do this.
Well, I appreciate that you're appreciating the listeners. I do, too. I hope people are wanting to hear more of this, because I'm excited about doing this kind of talk show radio and getting more guests at a local level to really explore how in Sonoma County we are living now and how we can live less destructively, with less energy, and more in touch with wilderness. We have a lot of folks who appreciate the natural beauty that we have here, and they come here to hike through the redwoods and along the coast and have a great appreciation for what's here, but maybe aren't as aware of how a lot of that is threatened by what's happening at the global level, and are concerned. And so I think you've come to a good place, and I hope to have you listeners come back on February 2nd at 11. So thank you again, Max. I really appreciate it, and I'll have to say goodbye now.
Thank you, Bernie. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Play.
Cows is made possible through underwriters like Occidental dentist Andre Shevchuk. Dr. Shevchuk offers a full range of dental care. His offices are located in Occidental at 4066 Bohemian Highway, and you can reach his office by calling 707-874-2447.
Cows thanks Rick Shubb at locally owned and operated Shubb Capos. Shubb has been providing musicians around the world with industry-standard capos since 1974. You can find out more about this venerable Sonoma County company on their website, which is Shubb, Shubb.com.
Now stay tuned for the Green Street News Show.
Now you're boiling over. Now you're wild as electric wires. Glass teeth and a windy smile.